Hello.
And welcome to my so-called lab. My so-called lab is a place for women scientists to talk to other women scientists about their work. At my so-called lab, it's a given that women and girls can do science, so we won't be discussing whether or not women and girls should pursue science or demonstrating evidence that women are just as good at science as men. What we will be discussing is how women are doing science, who these women are, and what their research is about. To that end, we're producing a series of interviews in which women scientists interview other women. So this is the first interview of that series. My name is Katherine Bryant. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Emory University. Today I'm interviewing my colleague, Erin Hecht. She is a research scientist at Georgia State University and Emory University. Erin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Erin, to start things off, can you tell me where your lab is?
I work at Georgia State and at Emory in Atlanta. But most of my research happens at Emory, and also we have a couple studies going on at the University of Georgia at Athens.
Okay, and can you tell me some things about your research question or what your overall research question is?
I guess I would say broadly I'm studying brain evolution, what it is about the brains of different animals that causes them to have different behaviors and cognitive abilities and temperaments. So generally, how has evolution modified brains to create specializations in behavior?
And what kind of species do you look at to kind of get at these evolutionary questions?
Well, a lot of my work started out looking at humans and our primate relatives, but now I'm shifting focus to look at canids. So those are dogs and related, you know, canine species. So I have one study where we are looking at domestic dogs of different breeds and trying to figure out what it is in their brains that causes them to have these different specialized skills like hunting or herding or, you know, being just a really good cuddle buddy on the couch. And then another study that we're doing is looking at the domesticated foxes from the Russian experiment that a lot of people have seen on nature TV shows. So we're comparing the brains of the tame and domesticated foxes to see what causes them to have these different temperaments.
Cool. And could you tell our listeners a little more about the project in Russia in case they haven't heard about it, where it is in Russia and what it's all about?
Sure. So this started about 50 years ago. There was a fur farm where some of the animals were not usable for fur because their coats were coming out the wrong color. And an ethologist, which is a scientist that studies behavior, got involved with this and started purposefully breeding the tamest foxes together. And within about 10 generations, they had foxes whose behavior was noticeably tame, more friendly towards humans. And they also were breeding together the least tame or most human-avoidant animals. So now, over 50 generations later, there are these two strains, a tame strain that looks and acts a lot like dogs, and an aggressive or avoidant strain that would prefer to avoid all human contact entirely and reacts aggressively if approached. And then there's also an unselected strain that is kept on the farm but bred non-selectively.
Okay. I think if I remember correctly, there were some interesting morphological changes in the tame strain. Is that right?
Yeah, their coats started showing up with a lot of different patterns and colors, kind of like domestic dogs. They have a characteristic white stripe, some of them do, down the front of their faces, which is something that shows up in a lot of domesticated animals, horses, cows, dogs, mm-hmm. cats. They breed twice a year instead of once a year.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
So you're comparing then the tame strain with the wild strain of foxes, is that right?
The tame strain with both the unselected strain and the aggressive strain.
Cool. And so how do you get at that? Are they sending you whole brains to look at, or?
We have the left hemispheres, and the right hemispheres are being studied by a collaborator of ours, Anna Kukukova, who is a behavioral geneticist, and she's at the University of Illinois.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Neat. Have you seen anything interesting so far in the Fox study?
Yeah, it seems like one of the major things that is different is these circuits that connect limbic regions, which are involved in instinctual emotional behavior, including fear and aggression, as well as social bonding, and how those circuits connect to frontal cortex, which is a sort of higher order region of the brain involved in the volitional control of behavior.
Maybe let's go back and talk more about the domestic dog study. So where do you find the dogs for your study, and can you talk a little bit about how you study them?
Sure. So the dogs are coming from just, you know, volunteers in the general, you know, world at large. People bring their dogs in. And then we also have one branch of the study where we're looking at specific breeds of dogs that are doing the behaviors that the breed was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be working with stock dog associations and hunting dog associations.
Wow, cool.
to get dogs that are actively doing the behavior that the breed was created for and that have been rated on that behavior, so we can tell like which herding dogs are good versus which ones are duds in terms of herding.
Right. So you're looking at herding then, and are you looking at hunting dogs?
That's the plan.
Yeah.
Herding dogs, hunting dogs, might do German Shepherds that are used for police work.
There's Right. So are you getting resting state data from this?
Yeah, resting state, structural MRI, and diffusion tensor imaging. So these are three different types of images that let you look at how functional activity is correlated across the brain, what the anatomy of different regions looks like, and how those regions are connected to each other.
Do you search out specific breeds, or do you just, when people volunteer, you assess, oh, this is a breed we haven't looked at yet?
So for the breed-specific study where we're looking at, you know, hunting and herding dogs, we're, you know, choosing those breeds beforehand. We have another branch of the study where we're just measuring behavior and taking genetic samples. And for that study, any dog can apply.
Cool. Okay. So could you talk a little bit about, so you originally were looking at human brains and chimpanzee brains, and now you're doing more with dogs. Could you talk about maybe some big differences between canid brains and great ape brains that are of interest?
Well, so primate brains and canine brains are very distantly related.
Mm-hmm.
Our last common ancestor is further back than the last common ancestor of humans and rodents.
Whoa.
So we are more closely related to mice than we are to dogs.
Wow.
Yeah, so although a dog brain looks more like a human brain than a mouse brain does.
Mm-hmm.
Both dog brain and human brain have a lot of gyri and sulci. They have some sort of like complex surface anatomy. Any similarities are likely to be not homologous but analogous, meaning that they have evolved large brains independently of us and sort of an example of parallel evolution.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah.
Are there any parts of the brain, since they're both somewhat large brains, that seem sort of different in how they've evolved, or maybe expanded differentially?
Yeah, frontal cortex appears to be much larger in primates and especially humans. And beyond that, I would say the jury's kind of still out.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that's one thing that will come out of this research.
Right, right. Do you have any guesses on difference? I think for me, the first thing I would think is maybe differences in visual areas because of...
Yeah, so
apes, you know, use a lot of visual information, and dogs don't have the most amazing vision.
Right, and dogs have highly developed olfactory skills, and they have a huge olfactory bulb and an entire olfactory lobe in the brain.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, and the olfactory bulb looks really cool on an MRI scan. It's got these like sort of delicate wavy tendrils extending all through the all through the nose. Yeah, it's cool.
You have to get a bloodhound.
Yeah. Actually, we do have one bloodhound scan.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it looks cool. I'll show you later.
Awesome. Yes. Okay. let's see. We have a few other questions to talk about. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how you got interested in science as a kid?
Sure. So when I was a kid, I remember my dad taking my sister and I to do a lot of stuff in nature. And one of those things was watching meteor showers, and during these times he would explain a lot about the night sky. So the fact that all of the stars were suns, and some of them were not just one sun, but an entire galaxy. And I think that really opened my eyes to how big nature is, and how much is unknown. And in general, as a kid, I remember spending a lot of time playing pretend about science, like being a scientist. I would conscript my sister and we would wander around the backyard and collect samples of things and put them in little jars, including some poor hapless insects.
So you were playing lab when other people were playing house, maybe.
Right.
Did you have little lab coats or anything?
We didn't. No, oh, okay. We were just, you know, wearing our grubby t-shirts and shorts.
Right.
And I also remember reading a lot of sort of popular science media, like Discover Magazine and watching the Discovery Channel, mm-hmm, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that really stimulated my interest in science. And now being a real-life scientist myself, I want to contribute to that type of thing and try to communicate science to the broader public and maybe reach some more young kids.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, and so now that you are a scientist, is there anything that's surprising or different than what you expected when you sort of dreamed about being a scientist as a kid?
I would say that being a scientist in real life is both more challenging and more fun than I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging because you spend months or sometimes even years working really hard to get an answer in an experiment, and sometimes the answer isn't what you expected, or sometimes it's difficult to interpret.
Mm-hmm.
So the rate at which you get sort of payback for all your hard work is sometimes really slow.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the sort of day-to-day of doing science, I think, is just really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I work with people who are smart and creative and make me think every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you never know what's going to happen from one day to the next. There's always a possibility that you'll be surprised. And it just feels like playing. Like, mm-hmm, it kind of feels like I'm still a little kid tinkering around in the backyard.
Yeah, that's it. What you're saying reminds me of some of the things that Hope Jahren talks about in her book, Lab Girls. The laboratory is a sanctuary, a place you can go and sort of have your own space, almost like a creative space. You know, I think as scientists, we do get to have a sort of sanctuary in the lab, but sometimes there are situations in which the outside world still intrudes on that space. And I'm thinking specifically of certain political issues we've had in this country in the last, I guess now it's 8 months or so. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about an instance in which the political climate has sort of intruded upon that sanctuary.
Sure. Yeah. So I think one moment that stands out is the day after the presidential election. So I remember waking up that morning and realizing that the country was now going to have a president that was both overtly anti-science and didn't seem to have any respect at all for women. So I was frustrated and upset. But I came to lab, and there's a young woman who's been working with me for the past year or two. She just finished college last year, and she's sort of my first real mentee. And she was also frustrated and upset, and she wanted to go home because she felt uncomfortable with people in this professional environment where she was, you know, trying to become a scientist herself. She didn't want to interject emotion into that or to have people see her cry.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her that the same thought had crossed my mind that morning, but that I felt like where I needed to be in order to push back against this change in events was to be in the lab, to be standing my ground, to just keep doing what I've been doing and, you know, be a scientist, not back down.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of women scientists felt that way that day. And certainly in a very concrete way, I think we worry about funding, we worry about the future of science in this country. So we're finding ourselves engaging a little more politically than we had been before, which is exciting, I think.
Yeah, it's maybe a silver lining.
Yes,
in a way.
I think so. So you mentioned that you have your first mentee now, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about a mentor who was important for you as you trained up to become a scientist.
Sure. I think the most significant mentor I've had in science was the person that was my dissertation advisor in grad school. Her name is Lisa Parr, and I'm still working with her now. I learned a lot from her, you know, sort of in the textbook type of realm of knowledge, like how to design an experiment, how to interpret results. But I think the bigger, more important thing that I learned from her was how to approach being a scientist in general. So I always had the impression that she was driven less by the need to advance a particular theory or get a certain number of journal articles, and more by genuine curiosity about a particular question, about something about how the natural world works. So that's what I have tried to keep as the motivation for my own work. So I think what drives me on a sort of day-to-day basis in these months or years when you're waiting to get the result of these experiments is the knowledge that eventually there will be a moment when you will have that result And then there will be this little corner of reality that nobody else has seen before, that for a little while, only you get to see. It's like, you know, a new addition to reality that you're bringing into the realm of knowledge. So to me, that's very motivating and just kind of amazing and beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you, Erin, for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. And that concludes our first installment of the My So-Called Lab podcast. Thanks for joining us and hope you can join us for our next interview.